Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 20th of October 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 12 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to briefly revisit a very worrying case that we've been following here on Reality Check, and that is the case of Tamar Stitt. Then, to lighten things up a bit, we're going to look at the perennially fun issue of UFOs. First of all, we'll take a look at the history of the UFO culture, and then we'll talk to a physics professor to find out, even if extraterrestrials exist on other planets, how possible is it that they could actually travel across space to get to Earth? Then in our movie review section, we'll review 1 1/8 new movies. Mao's Last Dancer is one of them. And, well, to find out what the 1/8 is all about, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's our LGBT news for the last week or so. First up, let's go to California, where last Monday, October 12th, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed into law two interesting bills related to LGBT rights. The first was a bill to make the 22nd of May Harvey Milk Day in California. Apparently, this marks the first time in the history of the U.S. that a state will officially recognize and celebrate the contributions of an openly LGBT person with an annual day of specific significance. And the other bill that the governor signed into law on the same day was a bill that means that California will now legally recognize same-sex marriages performed in other jurisdictions, but only during the period from April the 1st, 2001, when the Netherlands became the first country to start performing same-sex marriages, until November the 5th, 2008, when Proposition 8 was passed and same-sex marriage was banned in California after having been legal there for a period of 4.5 months. So it's all a bit complicated, really, all because of that annoying Proposition 8. After Prop 8 was passed last year, there was a lot of uncertainty as to the status of the 18,000 same-sex marriages that had been performed in California during that 4.5 month window, as well as the status of marriages performed in other states and other countries. Now, the issue of the 18,000 Californian same-sex marriages was decided by the Californian Supreme Court in May this year, and that court held that they are legally valid. And so this new law now effectively applies that recognition to marriages performed in other jurisdictions as well, as long as they were done before that tragic day last year when Proposition 8 was passed. It's all so complicated and so unnecessarily complicated. But it is looking now like possibly a new referendum might come up next year to repeal Proposition 8, so hopefully Californians won't have to put up with all this complication for too much longer. From California, let's move now to Uganda in East Africa, where David Bahati, a member of parliament from the ruling party, last week tabled a private member's bill in the Ugandan parliament designed to crack down even further on homosexuality in the country. Sexual relations between two people of the same sex is already a crime in Uganda, punished by up to 14 years jail, but this bill will increase that penalty to life imprisonment and also create a new crime called aggravated homosexuality. That means that people who engage in sexual relations with members of the same sex will now face the death penalty if their partner is disabled or under 18. A person who is HIV positive will also face the death penalty if they have sex with someone of the same sex. Now, doesn't that sound like a charming new law and great public policy? So that means that if a man happens to be HIV positive and has consensual, safe sex with his male partner, he will face the death penalty. Or if a woman happens to have a partner who is hearing impaired and she has sex with her, she will also face the death penalty. The bill also creates the new offences of promoting homosexuality, aiding and abetting homosexuality, and keeping a house for purposes of homosexuality. But it's okay, dear listener, because the MP David Bahati says his bill is designed to protect children, youths, and the traditional family. Well, that's reassuring, isn't it? Needless to say, a coalition of human rights groups have condemned this bill, but it looks like it has the support of the parliament and the president, so we'll probably get through. Well, whatever happens, you can be sure that we'll keep you up to date of developments here on Reality Check. Now, finally, from Uganda to another country that starts with U, but this time in South America, Uruguay, where they just seem to be marching ahead in leaps and bounds when it comes to LGBT rights. Now, we reported on this show a few weeks ago that Uruguay had introduced adoption rights for same-sex couples, and last week the National Assembly there unanimously passed a bill to give a number of very important rights to transsexual people. Under the new legislation, transsexuals will now be able to change their name on all official documents, from birth certificates to passports, to reflect the gender of their choice. This bill was strongly opposed by the Catholic Church in Uruguay, but thankfully the legislature resisted their pressure tactics and pushed the bill through. These are really important rights, actually, for transsexual people, because it means that when they apply for jobs or government services, health or education or things like that, the way that they look and present themselves and identify themselves will reflect what it says on their official documents. So that's a great breakthrough there from Uruguay, and fantastic to hear more good news for LGBT people coming out of there. Okay, let's take a break now and listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll briefly look at new developments in the case of Tamar Stitt, the 10-year-old girl receiving so-called natural therapies for liver cancer in El Salvador. Then we'll have a look at the mysterious history of UFOs. So stay tuned for that after this song here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Laika by Meccano, a song actually about the first dog in space sent up by the Soviets back in the 50s. And unfortunately, Laika was sent up into space and she barked and they heard that she was there and she was still alive, but they hadn't planned to bring her back down to Earth again, so she died soon after and stayed spinning out there in outer space. Okay, now we move into the part of the show where we get into an analysis of topics related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And first up today, we're going to look at some developments in a case that we've been following here on the show, and that is the very serious and worrying case of Tamar Stitt, the 10-year-old girl from Perth who has liver cancer and is now in El Salvador receiving so-called natural therapies to treat it. She was being treated at a hospital in Perth in Western Australia, and doctors were going to begin a course of chemotherapy, but back in early September, her mother took her out of the country to El Salvador to avoid a court order requiring her to undergo chemotherapy and so that she could pursue natural therapies for her liver cancer over there. Now, the development in this case is that a couple of Sundays ago, on the 11th of October, Channel 7's current affairs show, Sunday Night, did a report on Tamar Stitt, and their reporter travelled to El Salvador to meet with the whole family and see what the natural therapy is that they're using to treat Tamar's liver cancer. I should also mention that after seeing the show, I realised that I'd been pronouncing her name incorrectly. I'd been saying Tamar, but I now see that the correct pronunciation is Tamar. Now, if you'd like to watch that Sunday Night report, you can find it by doing a Google search for the words quackery over science and blip, because the video is on the blip.tv website. So that's quackery over science, blip. But I should warn you, it does make for extremely disturbing viewing. You see the little girl, Tamar, who is obviously extremely ill and extremely depressed, and you see her parents giving all kinds of rationalizations about why they refuse to let her undergo chemotherapy and why they're so sure the natural therapy will work. The cognitive dissonance you see going on in the minds of Tamar's parents is really incredible. And the worst part of it is that we get to see what the mysterious natural therapy is that they're using. Now, I first spoke about this case on episode 6 of Reality Check back on September the 8th, and soon afterwards I received a comment on the Reality Check webpage about what I'd said from Trevor Stitt, who is Tamar's father. At that time, he didn't mention what natural therapy Tamar was receiving, but just said that it would be revealed within a few weeks. Well, that has happened. On the Sunday Night show, Tamar's therapy was revealed, and I have to say, although I was expecting something bad, it's even worse than I'd imagined. The therapy that Tamar Stitt is receiving to cure her liver cancer is herbal tea and mud baths. That's it. They collect red clay from the hills around the house in El Salvador, mix it with water, and every day, twice a day, for 3 hours, the mud is wrapped around Tamar's torso. According to Tamar's mother, this clay can cure any kind of illness. It dries up anything that is causing the illness and draws out the toxins and kills the cancer. Now, as I mentioned, it is incredibly depressing and frustrating to watch this video. And the most frustrating part is that you can't doubt the sincerity of the parents to cure their daughter. They obviously really want Tamar to get better. And yet, any reasonable observer can clearly see that they've made the wrong decision and that the decisions they're now making are obviously going to lead to their daughter's death. And that's not what they want or what anyone wants. Yet because of their cognitive dissonance or whatever, they just refuse to see what is glaringly obvious to any outside observer. Now, I've spoken about this case twice before, so I don't want to go into it again too much today, but I did want to make three brief comments. The first is that they said that they didn't want Tamar to have chemotherapy because it wouldn't be nice for her to lose her hair, to temporarily lose her hearing, and to be nauseous and vomiting a lot of the time, which would happen with chemotherapy. So these are quality of life issues, basically. And of course, it would be extremely unpleasant and traumatic to go through that. But yet, the alternative that they've chosen, the route that they've chosen, gives her much worse quality of life. Because as the cancer progresses, Tamar is most likely going to suffer extreme pain and she'll ultimately die in a horrible way. And even when the Channel 7 reporter points this out to the parents, they just can't seem to deal with it. The father just says that they'll cross that bridge if and when they get to it. The second comment I wanted to make is that the father in particular keeps suggesting that this was Tamar's decision to refuse the chemotherapy and go on natural therapies, that they explained to her the various options and that she chose not to undergo the chemo because she didn't want to lose her hair and have all the other complications. And he also implies this in the comment that he made on the Reality Check webpage. But Tamar is 10 years old. Quite obviously, she can't be the one making decisions about her medical treatment. Those decisions have to be taken by her parents. And that leads me to the third and final comment on this case for today, and that is that it's also clear from seeing the Sunday night story that the Tits are very devout Christians of some persuasion, and they say many times, particularly Trevor, the father, that whether Tamar lives or dies is in the hands of God. It's all up to God to decide. Well, that to me seems like an easy way to shift responsibility and maybe to cope psychologically. And while, of course, there is always an element of chance in medical treatments, it seems to me that in this case, it was very clearly up to the parents to make all the decisions. And despite their best intentions, I suspect that they have made terribly wrong decisions. And tragically, it is probably now too late to do anything to save Tamar. So this is obviously an extremely grim, depressing, and frustrating case. And, well, that's all that we'll say about it for today. So let's move now into something a lot more fun, and that is the mysterious and unearthly issue of UFOs. Now, this year, 2009, marks the 400th anniversary since Galileo designed a telescope and began to use it to look up at the night sky. And for that reason, this year has been officially declared by UNESCO to be the International Year of Astronomy. So with this in mind, our eyes are apt to wander upwards at night to examine the stars and the planets above us and to wonder, Could there be other intelligent creatures out there somewhere looking back? And not only could they be out there somewhere, but could they already be here? Well, many people think so. Today, I thought we'd have a look at the history of the UFO in pop culture and how that culture has developed and evolved over the last 60 years or so. Then after that, we'll have a look at some of the real science of UFOs. We'll interview a physics professor and find out just how extraterrestrials might be able to get to Earth if, in fact, they do exist on other planets. But first, to the history of the UFO. And for this historical look, I'm relying very heavily on an article written by Robert Schaefer that appeared in the January 2009 edition of Skeptical Inquirer magazine. Robert Schaefer is an engineer and amateur astronomer and a longtime UFO investigator for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry in the United States. Now, the UFO phenomenon basically really first took off in the 1940s. During that decade, some science fiction magazines began to publish fantastical stories about visitors from other planets. But it was really the case of Kenneth Arnold in 1947 that brought UFOs to prominence in the mainstream media and marked the beginning of the modern UFO culture as we know it today. Kenneth Arnold was a private pilot who, on June 24, 1947, while flying near Mount Rainier in Washington State in the U.S., reported seeing 9 airborne objects that flew, quote, "like a saucer if you skip it across the water," end quote. Interestingly, he later claimed that he never said that the objects looked like saucers, just that they moved like skipping saucers. And in fact, he said that they looked like crescent-shaped boomerangs. The newspaper reports, however, simply described saucer-like objects, and this is the image that captured the public's imagination. And very soon afterwards, other reports started coming in from across the United States and across the world of other sightings of so-called flying saucers. Over the next 25 years or so, these sightings seem to have come and gone in waves. There would be a media report of a sighting somewhere, and then, fueled by the media excitement, reports would start to come in from across the US and elsewhere. Then, gradually, the hype would die down for a few years, and then suddenly spring back again with another news report that would set off a fresh round of flying saucer sightings. This went on until 1973, when the last major national wave of UFO sightings in the US took place. No one is really sure why the mass national sightings stopped in 1973, but it's speculated that after 20 years of pure anecdotes with no tangible evidence of any real alien spacecraft, that maybe the public just started to lose interest. Of course, individuals still continued to report sightings after 1973, but these never again spread into a nationwide phenomenon as they had in those early years. Now, the next development in UFO culture began in 1966 and lasted for about the next 30 years. And this was that gradually UFO culture came to be dominated by stories of alien abductions rather than simple sightings of flying saucers. The thing that kicked off this particular phase was the publication in 1966 of a book called The Interrupted Journey by John G. Fuller, a book that detailed the alleged UFO abduction in rural New Hampshire of Betty and Barney Hill, 5 years earlier in 1961. The Hills were driving along some lonely country roads one night when they were supposedly pursued by a UFO. A couple of weeks later, Betty began having nightmares about being abducted by aliens and having bizarre experiments performed on her. And the couple belatedly concluded that during that fateful night, there had been periods of missing time. They came to believe that the abduction dreams were actually memories of what had happened to them during that so-called missing time. Then later, Barney Hill, when hypnotized by a psychiatrist, recounted stories of abduction similar to Betty's nightmares, which Barney had obviously heard her repeat many times. And it's the descriptions of aliens given by Barney while under hypnosis that led to the classic image we have today of the grey alien with skinny limbs and a big bulbous head and big black eyes. The Betty and Barney Hill abduction story became a media sensation and sparked articles, books, TV series, and a movie called The UFO Incident. Soon, other people started coming forward with abduction stories and supposedly repressed memories. Another famous abduction story that got a lot of media attention a few years later was the case of Travis Walton, who was supposedly abducted by aliens in Arizona for 5 days in 1975. That story was made into a movie called Fire in the Sky in 1993. Most of the alien abduction stories that began surfacing in the 70s had a similar theme. The victim had been traveling on a remote country road at night and had seen lights in the sky that came closer and closer. The victim became frightened and then couldn't remember exactly what happened next. But later, under hypnosis, they recovered their repressed memories of alien abduction. This also coincides with the time that Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out in 1977. A few years later, in 1981, when the book Missing Time was published, it became clear that the aliens could not just abduct you on lonely country roads at night, but they could even come right into your bedroom and snatch you at any time, even if you lived in the middle of a big city. There was nowhere to hide. This book was followed by more books, articles, and TV shows, and established a new paradigm in which you don't just have chance encounters with aliens, but they come looking for you. And abductees even establish a personal relationship with their abductor and are in fact abducted several times. And so gradually, with all these various kinds of abduction stories, we see the UFO culture by the 1990s becoming intertwined with the phenomenon of recovered memories. But then eventually, like the flying saucer phase before it, after 30 years of dubious abduction stories without ever producing any tangible evidence, the phenomenon began to wane. These days, amongst UFO believers, people with abduction stories are generally seen as marginal or passé. So what is the UFO culture like today? Well, Robert Schaefer points out that it's basically split into two broad camps. You have the New Age ufologists and the so-called scientific ufologists. The New Age ufologists, these are the ones that just can't relate to the idea that someone should have to prove their extraordinary claims. They just accept unsubstantiated accounts of communications with extraterrestrials. They're not concerned about evidence, but rather with personal revelation. Some people are just lucky enough to be contacted by UFOs through secret channels of communication such as telepathy, channeling, or dreams. And they receive cosmic wisdom from their friends at the other end of the galaxy. They talk about an imminent metaphysical change in the Earth and or the dawning of a new golden age for humanity if we would just accept the insights of our cosmic brethren. In the other camp are the so-called scientific ufologists. They understand the importance of evidence in proving their claims and are very interested in collecting as many UFO photos and video shots as they can, as well as retrieving material from supposed UFO crash sites. They believe that the weight of evidence in the form of sightings, photos, video, abductions, marks left on the ground by spacecraft, plus pieces of crashed spacecraft, all these clearly prove that Earth is indeed being visited by extraterrestrials. Unfortunately, their idea of proof is not really up to the standard used by most working scientists as being adequate to provide convincing evidence. But these scientific ufologists have another card up their sleeve. Because the reason they can't come up with the watertight, compelling evidence required by science is because of a great conspiracy. And this is where the UFO culture gets deeply intertwined with the conspiracy theory culture. We can't collect material or alien bodies from crash sites because the men in black who work for some shady unnamed branch of the federal government, such as the so-called Majestic 12, always get there first and take away any evidence that might be revealing. And what's more, this is an international conspiracy, supposedly, with governments all over the world colluding to cover up the extensive evidence of alien visitation. As to why all governments would want to cover up evidence of alien visitation, I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, a classic case of the conspiracy theory in relation to UFOs is the incident at Roswell in New Mexico, which, although the flying saucer is alleged to have crashed there in 1947, only became part of the conspiracy theory in 1980, when a book was released supposedly revealing the truth about this shady incident. By the way, as an aside, that 1980 book called The Roswell Incident was written by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. Now that's Charles Berlitz, the linguist and language teacher who founded the Berlitz language schools and language books. But he was also responsible for a lot of the hype surrounding the Bermuda Triangle when he published a book called The Bermuda Triangle in 1974 that went on to sell over 20 million copies. And as we saw back in episode 8 of Reality Check, the approach to facts and evidence of the best-selling authors on the Bermuda Triangle leaves quite a lot to be desired. And it's an approach that he takes up again in his book on the Roswell incident. Anyway, that, dear listener, is a potted history of the UFO movement over the last 62 years or so. In which direction will it head from here? It seems about time for a whole new UFO paradigm to re-energize the mythology. I wonder what they'll come up with next. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I'm sure it will be interesting, whatever it is. Okay, let's go to a song now, and when we come back, we'll have a chat with physics professor Raymond Volkas about some real science relevant to UFOs. What do the laws of physics say about the possibility that our little planet here is being visited by extraterrestrials? Well, stay tuned and you'll find out after this song here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard is a song called Tirineno Tzitziki by Lila Downs from Mexico. Now, let's return to the issue of UFOs and extraterrestrial visitors. This is a huge topic, and I think we're going to have to come back to it next week and look a bit more closely at whether the supposed evidence for extraterrestrial visitation of Earth actually stands up to scrutiny. But today I thought we'd ask the question, even if intelligent creatures do actually exist on other planets in other solar systems, how could they get to Earth? Because space is big, really, really big, unimaginably big, in fact. You think you can just hop in a spaceship, something like the space shuttle, and fly from star to star? Well, actually, it's not quite that easy. A space shuttle normally goes at about 27,000 kilometers an hour. Now, that sounds fast. I mean, that's 27 times faster than a jumbo jet. So at that speed, we could get to the moon in about a day, and we could get to Mars in a few months. But do you know how long it might take to get to Alpha Proxima? That's the nearest star to our sun. That's about 4 light years away. Well, 4 light years doesn't sound that far. Well, so flying in a spaceship, that would take, I don't know, maybe a few years, 10, 20, 40, longer? Don't tell me it's 100 years. Well, no, it's not 100 years. It's even more than 100 years. I saw someone do this calculation on the internet, and they came up with the figure of 170,000 years. Now, that's a long time, a prohibitively long time, in fact. So that means that even if intelligent extraterrestrials do exist somewhere in the galaxy, maybe they'll never be able to drop in for a visit. And we'll never be able to pay them a visit. So, well, to talk about these issues and other questions related to physics and UFOs, I decided to have a chat to a physics professor. And it's that interview that we'll hear right now. Okay, I'm joined in the studio now by Professor Raymond Volkas, who is a professor of physics at Melbourne University. Thank you very much for coming in to Reality Check.
Oh, thank you, Tony.
All right, now, today we're looking at the issue of UFOs and possible extraterrestrial visitors to Earth. But from what I understand, well, at least given our current technology of space travel, it would actually be pretty difficult, if not impossible, for us, with our technology, to get to another star.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, it takes a few days to get to the moon, and I don't know exactly how long it would take to get to Mars with the planned technologies, but I think it's a few months. And the nearest star is a lot further away than Mars is. I mean, the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, is something like 4 light years away. So it takes light, which travels very, very quickly, 4 years to get from here to Alpha Centauri. And if you just look at the ratio of the distances, you can between, you know, here and Mars and here and Alpha Centauri, you can already see a big problem. I haven't calculated exactly, you know, how long it would take to get to Alpha Centauri, using you know, sort of a similar mechanism as we would use to get to Mars, but it would be many human lifetimes. I don't know how many. I mean, it could be tens of thousands of years. I'm really not sure, but it's a very, very long time. And I mean, you have to bear in mind that you have to carry enough fuel. I mean, you need to worry about all sorts of things. And you could say, well, we could explore alternative ways of propulsion, and I think you would have to consider traveling to a nearby star. So people have thought about, for example, using photon sails. So these are literally kind of sail-like things where the photons from the sun, the light from the sun, would, you know, the electromagnetic radiation from the sun would hit these sails and cause a force which would propel the spacecraft onwards. And I mean, the advantage of that is that the propulsion technique wouldn't require you to carry, you know, fuel.
Right.
Of course, I mean, you don't need fuel all the way. You just need fuel to accelerate up to a certain point, and then you would coast, and then you'd need fuel to decelerate when you got to the other star. However, if you wanted to do it within a human lifetime, you would have to accelerate the spacecraft very, very profoundly, and I don't think we have the faintest idea how to do that. And the other thing that you have to bear in mind is there's a fundamental limit from the laws of physics, from the theory of relativity, which is that, in fact, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And that's a fact, and it's verified every day in particle accelerators. So, you know, the shortest amount of time you could imagine taking to get to Alpha Centauri is 4 years, all right. But to accelerate something as massive as a spacecraft to near the speed of light would just take a phenomenal amount of energy, and I don't know how you would store that energy, where you would get it from. I haven't calculated it, but it would just be phenomenal. So if you then think a little bit further about how we might do it, if we were prepared to spend many human lifetimes, on a voyage to the nearest star.
Mm-hmm.
So you could imagine traveling much more slowly and just having some enormous spacecraft, okay, and having people live out their lives and breed and so on and produce the next generation all on the spacecraft. It would be a very strange way to live. And I don't know psychologically what it would do to humans.
Yeah. And given the amounts of time involved, we might actually evolve into a slightly different species.
Well, it was certainly if after maybe thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, I don't know, whatever it is, the generations which eventually came back to Earth, I don't know if they would be able to deal with it, or even if there would be any kind of civilization left for them to deal with. I mean. There are so many imponderables. I mean, but that's about the only way you could think of doing it. Have some big spacecraft and just have people live and die on that for thousands of years, thousands and tens of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. It's the only way you could think of doing it, unless you could figure out some way to get close to the speed of light. The other factor that should be mentioned is, I mean, relativity has a lot of peculiar features. And another one is that when you move fast, time slows down for you. So in fact, if you had a spacecraft that left Earth, traveled close to the speed of light, and went a long distance, let's say much further than Alpha Centauri, let's say 1,000 light years. So 1,000 light years round trip would close to the speed of light would take 2,000 years, mm-hmm. from the point of view of the people on the Earth. Okay. But from the point of view of the people on the spacecraft, time is slowing down. So in fact, if you were traveling very close to the speed of light, you could travel 1,000 light years and come back within your own lifetime.
Right.
Of course, then 2,000 years would have lapsed on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be no one left that you knew, and everything would be different. So I mean, people speculate about that, but there's still the fundamental problem of how you actually get a spacecraft up to those sorts of speeds.
To that kind of speed.
Yeah, and I don't think we have the faintest idea how to do that.
No, and if you are traveling at that speed, you certainly wouldn't want to hit a speck of dust or a pebble along the way.
Well, right. I mean, micrometeorites, there are all sorts of issues to consider.
Yeah.
It really is, it really is a fantastic thing to contemplate. We're not even close to being able to do that. And one of the reasons why, extraterrestrials are so thin on the ground may be that this is, in fact, such a fundamental limitation,
mm-hmm.
That even if there are intelligent life forms out there, and even if there are, thousands of them in the galaxy, it may be that none of them can figure out how to get around the laws of physics in this regard. And it's kind of disappointing, I suppose, but, you know, that's reality, apparently. So that may well be why you know, we seem to be completely alone.
Well, can we head off into the realm of speculation now and think of other possibilities that, okay, looking with the technology we have now, with the laws of physics as we understand them at the moment, it's looking pretty impractical, if not impossible, to travel from to another star. But I have heard certain theories that it might be possible using wormholes or other types of technology. Can you possibly speculate about that kind of thing?
Well, okay, so that would be one way in principle you could get around the speed of light barrier. So the idea is that if you're traveling in through ordinary space, the speed of light is an absolute upper limit to how fast you can go. However, in Einstein's general theory of relativity, which deals with the structure of space-time and gravity and the expansion of the universe and so on, it turns out that space is something that has properties, just like other things have properties, and it has dynamics, as we say as physicists. It actually can change with time, and it can change its character from one place to another. So space-time is kind of a thing that has properties, and you can do things to it. So mass and energy warp or curve space-time and, you know, can change the conditions of space-time. And, I mean, there have been speculations for a long, long time that it might be possible to set up a suitable configuration of mass and energy that you can create shortcuts from one place in our universe to another place in our universe. So you don't actually have to travel through regular space to get from point A to point B. You can take a shortcut through a wormhole, which represents a severely curved and distorted tunnel through space-time. So, look, I mean, this is in principle something to think about.
Right.
Again, even if, I mean, I'm not even completely sure that it has been proven that this is in principle possible. It may be. Let's suppose it is. But even if it is, again, to set up the conditions to create a wormhole and to control it and so on, again, involves fantastic speculations about future technology. It's, you know, so far over the horizon, it's not funny.
Right, yeah, I wanted to ask you that. So no one has ever created a wormhole yet?
Of course not.
No, right, okay. So it's still very much in the area of pure speculation.
And in fact, no one has even found evidence of one out in the universe. These are theoretical speculations, and, you know, again, the fact that no one has visited us might be a hint that in fact wormholes don't exist, or even if they do, that it's impossible to use them for safe space travel. You know, that it takes such a fantastic amount of energy to create them that no one can do it. I mean, we can't do it, and no other beings can do it.
That they are impossible.
You know, the fact that there is no evidence for life other than on planet Earth, intelligent life, or indeed any sort of life, but in particular intelligent life, is surely telling us something about the difficulties of space travel. Some people may argue that the probability of there being any other intelligent life is close to zero, and others would argue that it ought to be fairly common. If it is fairly common, then the fact that we haven't been obviously visited by extraterrestrials says something about it says something about the combination of how difficult it is to do space travel across those distances and how densely populated the galaxy is.
Right, you with know. Life, intelligent life.
I mean, obviously, if there are intelligent beings on Alpha Centauri, and they've been there for thousands of years and have had a technologically advanced civilization, you know, it would be much more likely that we should have been visited by them, or we should have detected them in some way, detected radio signals or whatever. And that's the other thing. I mean, astronomers have been looking for signature, you know, signals like radio signals or other kinds of signals of intelligent civilizations, and haven't found any yet. Of course, the search volume is enormous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it may not be a surprise because we've only explored a small fraction of the galaxy. But one way or another, it must be that either intelligent life is very rare, or space travel across those distances is very hard, or a combination of the two.
Right. Now, I just mentioned wormholes because that's a theory I've heard about. Is there any other possible way that we could travel such large distances that you've heard speculated about?
Not really. Mm. That's the main one.
Right.
I mean, of course, I mean, we could maybe one day discover that the theory of relativity is not exactly correct. And, you know, people speculate along these lines. I'm not aware that any of those speculations have turned to the problem of space travel. So, you know, my statements about the difficulty of avoiding, you know, the dictums of relativity, it does assume that relativity is 100% correct. And we have a lot of evidence that it's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So even if it's not quite correct, it's still correct enough that I think it does pose serious, in principle, limitations on space travel of those distances. But that could be another way, that there could just be some laws of physics that we don't know about yet that one day could be exploited.
Right. So all in the realm of pure speculation.
Absolutely pure speculation.
Right. Well, let's hope that something comes up. It would be nice to be able to visit other stars at some point in time.
Well, it would. It would, but don't hold your breath.
No. All right. Now, I did have another question that I wanted to ask you briefly, and that is, in all the movies where you see extraterrestrials coming to Earth, their spaceship appears normally above a city or something, and the spaceship just hovers there, this huge ship. And I always wondered, well, how could a huge metallic ship that obviously doesn't have like a helicopter rotor blade on top, and it's not moving like an aeroplane, how could a ship like that just hover? Is there any way, can our technology, current technology, think of a way to explain that or to do that?
Well, this is a very amusing point. I mean, I'd never thought of that before, but sure, I mean, there's just no way. I mean, to hover, you need to exert a force that counteracts the force of gravity. So a helicopter does it by having rotors spin around, which sends, you know, a draft of air down. The helicopter is able to hover, and hovering aircraft use a similar technique. They fire air. So one way or another, you need to throw some mass around so that you don't get pulled down to the ground because of the attraction of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And surely that would mean that if you were under this hovering enormous spacecraft, there would be great devastation because of downdrafts or whatever. I mean, I suppose, you know, maybe these filmmakers and so on are thinking about anti-gravity or something like that.
Right.
But again, there's zero evidence that anti-gravity exists.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, maybe there's some law of physics that we're unaware of and actually you can do this. But according to present understanding, it would have to be a helicopter-like situation, I would think.
I was talking about this to my brother, and he suggested, well, you know, balloons, helium balloons hover, so maybe they could evacuate the spacecraft and have a vacuum there, but then I don't know how they would then move up and down and move around. Or...
Yeah, a bit like a submarine.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, at least on the films, these aircraft look pretty heavy. Dense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, to think of an aircraft that has the consistency of a balloon, which is what you would need to be able to do that, and then also to have the capacity to, you know, re-enter, you know, leave and enter an atmosphere, and then travel across many light years, and you know, have to worry about radiation and all the rest of it. You have to protect the creatures inside. It seems very far-fetched. So no, I think the hovering thing is poetic license.
Okay, I did read in an article about someone proposing, and apparently they have, well, according to this article, they have invented some kind of thing based on ion, what was it called?
Ion propulsion.
Yeah, ion propulsion, ion wind downdrafts and ion propulsion that would, I guess, instead of using air like a helicopter or a hovering plane, they shoot down ions, which I guess gives them that inertia against gravity. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
Well, I'm aware of the general idea of iron-based propulsion. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I used to read about that as a kid, actually.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I haven't thought deeply about it. I mean, but one way or another, something, some kind of force, some kind of an effect has to be exerted in order to be able to hover. You can't just do it and not affect the situation underneath the spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And certainly the suggestion from these movies is that the spacecraft can just sort of sit there and people can walk around underneath.
Right.
and are apparently unaffected by it. I mean, apart from being sort of surprised that it's up there, but otherwise unharmed. That seems extremely implausible.
Right. Okay, so another explanation that is simply, well, it's beyond our technology to
Well,
understand.
Right, so that beyond our technology and beyond our laws of physics.
Yeah.
And of course, that's always possible, but, you know, you just can't see at the moment how it could be possible.
All right. Well, Professor Volkas, thank you very, very much for joining us here on Reality Check.
Thank you, Tony.
So there you have it, dear listener, the words direct from the mouth of a physics professor. Given the laws of physics as we currently understand them, it seems pretty unlikely that extraterrestrials could ever visit us. And if they do get here, it doesn't seem that they'll be able to fly around and hover like they do in the movies. But there are still so many questions to ask about UFOs, and more importantly, questions to answer about UFOs, that I think that we'll continue our discussion of UFOs on next week's episode of Reality Check. Now, finally, before we get into our last song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. And you can also visit our website too, if you like. There you can listen to previous episodes of Reality Check, and that's at realitycheckonline.net. All right, let's listen to our final song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was Lento by Julieta Venegas. Now, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and today we're going to review the new Australian film Mao's Last Dancer, plus an eighth of another film. Okay, let me explain. The eighth of a film that I saw was a movie called The Founding of a Republic, which is a film approved by the Chinese government that tells the story of the founding of the People's Republic of China, according to the official history approved by the Chinese Communist Party. Okay, so I knew it was going to be a propaganda piece, but I have a soft spot for lavish historical epics, and this was supposed to be a lavish affair indeed. A huge production with almost every Chinese movie star imaginable appearing somewhere in this grand historical tale. Unfortunately, I could only stand 15 minutes of this grand historical tale. As it leapt from scene to scene about negotiations between the KMT and the CPC, okay, those acronyms I could work out, and I could also recognize Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek. But when the scenes were just flying by at 100 miles an hour, and the subtitles were just flitting on and off, and there were lots of serious discussions about alliances between the PPCPP and the FLMLN and a host of other acronyms, and a Mr. Wu and a Mr. Lu and an I don't know who, and they were all wearing different uniforms, and I think we were supposed to know what uniform corresponded to what faction of what alliance, and I really did make an effort to follow everything for 15 long minutes. But then, as I was in a multiplex, I decided to flee what was turning out to be a tedious ordeal, and I ducked into another cinema just in time to catch the movie that's up for review today, Mao's Last Dancer. And just as the title suggests, Mao's Last Dancer is another film that deals with recent Chinese history. only, fortunately, in a much more comprehensible way than the founding of a republic. It tells the true story of Li Chun-Chin, who, as a small boy in Shandong province in 1972, is selected by some government officials to try out for the Beijing Ballet Company. He gets into the school and lives for many years in Beijing, training to be a ballet dancer. Then in the early 80s, when Li has grown into a young man, some dancers from the Houston Ballet visit Beijing and see Li's talent and invite him to visit Houston the following year. He travels to Houston in 1981, and the movie follows the dramatic events of his life over the next few years in Houston, when he decides to stay in the United States, but then constantly worries about the consequences for his family back in China. Interestingly, Mao's Last Dancer is an Australian production, even though it's set entirely in China and the United States. And I have to say that this film was quite a disappointment. Apparently, it's doing big business at the box office, but I found it very disappointing. The scenes in China are effective and interesting, and the acting in these scenes is great. The ending of the film is also quite touching and moving, and the scenes of Li dancing are great as well. The actor who plays Li, Chi Kao, is obviously a very skilled dancer himself. But the scenes in the US I found to be really grating, mostly for the corny dialogue and the very mediocre acting. This film is not subtle in any way. It seems as if the filmmakers were aiming for a mass market and so made every plot point as simple and obvious as possible and resort to really annoying clichés again and again. For example, there are really clichéd scenes of the young man from closed, oppressive, communist China arriving in the dazzling, dynamic United States and discovering so much freedom for the first time. There's even a classic clichéd scene when Li wakes up from a nightmare by sitting straight, bolt upright in bed. It's really tiresome. I wonder if anyone actually ever wakes up from nightmares like that. They do in cliched Hollywood movies, but in real life, well, I've never heard of it. And the acting is really grating as well. Lots of the actors are actually Australians putting on American accents, and sometimes I found myself wondering if a certain character was supposed to be Australian or American, judging by just the bizarre accent that they were putting on. And I think that, unfortunately, even though Chi Kao, who's the lead actor, is clearly a fantastic dancer, I don't think that his acting is strong enough to carry the whole film. But the most annoying thing about this movie is the depiction of the one gay male character in the story, who is actually the second most important character in the film, and that is the Englishman Ben Stevenson, the artistic director of the Houston Ballet, who's played by Bruce Greenwood, a Canadian actor. Now, his accent also tends to wander a bit, but it wasn't that bothered me. It was his limp-wristed mincing in every single scene. And for this, I blame the director, the Australian Bruce Beresford. He obviously told Bruce Greenwood, "Look, you're a homosexual, mate. You're supposed to mince and flap your hands around. Otherwise, the audience won't get it." Well, maybe the real Ben Stevenson does act like that. I don't know. But when you're making a film for a mass audience and you only have one gay character and you choose to make that character an obvious mincing queen, it's really, really annoying and smacks to me of homophobia. Maybe not explicit, obvious homophobia, but implicit homophobia, the kind that uses a common stereotype to tell the audience something about a character without saying it explicitly. This kind of stereotyping really bugs me a lot, because using the stereotype just perpetuates the stereotype. It would be so nice to see a mass-marketed multiplex movie like this one that's also going well at the box office. It would be so nice to see a film like this actually make an effort to challenge people's assumptions a little bit. But Mao's Last Dancer relies on annoying cliches and stereotypes, and in my opinion, this makes what was already a disappointing movie even slightly morally reprehensible. So, not one to go and check out, in my opinion. Okay, that brings us to the end of the 12th episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 13. Okay, have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.